Coming up on Boston Public Radio, we'll talk politics with Michael Astru, who has served four presidents, and John Nucci, who now serves Suffolk University. We'll talk probation hangovers on Beacon Hill, immigration politics coming to Massachusetts, and Obamacare going to the Supreme Court again. Then cameras and microphones are coming to school buses in Boston. Are they a good anti-bullying strategy or an invasion of students' rights?
We're all revved up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price and the botched Arizona execution. And what would Jesus do about climate change? We'll debate the ethics of the poor door. That is, some mixed-rate housing has one door for the well-to-do and another for the poor. Then the Globe's Shira Springer on some sporting news, including when you're a pro athlete, apparently it's better to knock out your girlfriend than smoke a joint. Plus, a surprise from the World Cup. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio. Hey, it's Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to 89.7 Boston Public Radio.
I know, we've only been here a year and a half.
Produced by WGBH 89.7. Sorry about that.
Good to see you, Marjorie.
Good to see you too, Jim.
The closest thing to a winner coming out of last week's probation verdict may be gubernatorial candidate Charlie Baker. The Republican will probably use this as an opportunity to highlight what he sees as the failures of one-party rule on Beacon Hill. So can the Democratic candidates, particularly the, I think it's fair to say, insiders like Steve Gross and Martha Coakley, play this without selling out their own party? Here with us in Studio 3 to look at this and other political news, state and national, is Michael Astru. Michael's a Republican who served as the commissioner of the Social Security Administration under Presidents Bush and Obama. Michael, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thanks for having me.
John Nucci returns. He is a Boston Herald columnist and vice president of government relations and community affairs at Suffolk University. John, good to see you too.
Great to be back.
Thank you both for coming in. Well, we're going to get to everything involving Charlie Baker and the governor's race and immigration in a second, but we have to start with something that Jim and I are somewhat obsessed with, and maybe you are too, the probation trial. There's some speculation that even though there were guilty verdicts for the three probation department employees, including former Commissioner John O'Brien, that the case is not over. Paul Ware, who's the independent counsel who was appointed by the state Supreme Judicial Court to investigate the probation department, says that House Speaker Robert DeLeo is wrong when he says he was not involved in this. He was not engaged in any kind of impropriety, that his investigation found that. The specter is raised here that we could have a fourth speaker now in trouble. John Nucci, what do you think?
Well, first of all, full disclosure, Bob DeLeo is a friend of mine. I've known him for many years. In fact, we went to high school together.
So I didn't know you went to high school.
We did.
He's a great guy. Everybody loves him.
He was a couple of years older than I am. Yep. He's a couple of years ahead of me at Boston Latin School.
But so how come you're not working at the probation department?
I never made a call.
Okay, just want to be clear.
I don't say this because I'm friendly with Bob DeLeo. I don't think you're going to see the speaker get indicted or anyone else up at the State House in terms of elected officials have any further involvement in this. Paul Ware, and I think I'm pretty much quoting, if I'm not quoting, I'm paraphrasing, said in his report that there's no evidence that the speaker did anything inappropriate. I don't think that's a stretch for Bob DeLeo to say that Paul Ware's report cleared him of any wrongdoing.
Yeah. Ware is now saying that part of his mandate was not to look at the legislature. Specifically, the SJC said not to look at the legislature.
And part of his mandate was not to look at Jim Browdy, Marjorie Egan, or John Nucci. I think I can safely say, and you can safely say, that Paul Ware did not find that we did anything inappropriate in the probation scandal. So I think that's what Speaker DeLeo was saying when he said that. It was not his mandate. In fairness, it was not Paul Ware's mandate to look at elected officials, but there's no reason that he, and I'm not sure he's suggesting this, but there's no reason to assume that had he looked at that, there would have been wrongdoing.
Michael, did you go to high school with Bob DeLeo? Just want to be clear.
I did not. I don't even know the gentleman.
Do you think there's more? I mean, Deval Patrick's quote was after the verdict, this is the end of it. Is it the end of it?
Well, I certainly hope not. I think the probation department is just a subsample of the culture in a lot of state government. And we should be asking Martha Coakley to be doing more. We should be asking Carmen Ortiz to be doing
more.
U.S.
attorney, yeah.
U.S. attorney. I mean, if you've had interactions with the local culture, and it's the federal government, too. I've seen it even in the federal government. This kind of corruption is rampant, and it's a shame that we haven't seen more prosecutions and more attempts to root it out. I think the establishment has been very lackadaisical about it.
You know, I have to say, I have no idea what Bob DeLeo did and didn't do other than that, which is undisputed, like nominate his godson, etc. I think that the fact that the U.S. attorney chose to call him an unindicted co-conspirator in the middle of the trial, did not mention him in the opening statement, and he had no vehicle other than a press release to try to exonerate himself, is unconscionable. If he allegedly was part of this quid pro quo, then indict the guy. If not, he is put between the proverbial rock and the hard place, isn't he, Michael Astro?
Well, I think that's right in terms of reputation, but on the other hand, he spent a substantial amount of money to try to avoid indictment. So it does seem, after the fact, then to claim it's unfair to say he had nothing to do with it at all. Doesn't seem right to me. And at some point, if you're an unindicted co-conspirator, it doesn't seem right to be going around claiming vindication. You should be a little bit more humble than that.
I mean, I think we're all politically sophisticated enough to know that had Carmen Ortiz felt she could have indicted Bob DeLeo, had she felt that she could have had as a trophy the Speaker of the House, she would have done that. And the fact that that didn't occur is, for whatever reason, it didn't occur.
You know, there's some reports unconfirmed that it wasn't her decision. It was Eric Holder, the U.S. the Attorney General,
right,
saying, I don't want to see any Democrats,
right,
top-ranking Democrats, indicted in a midterm election
year.
I don't know if that's true or not,
but maybe it is.
When you look at the stories, too, that that the Senate President, Teresa Murray, is accused of appointing lots of people that were absolutely unqualified. Let me ask you, I hate to put you on the spot, but you're here, I'm going to put you on the spot.
Who are you talking to?
John Nucci.
Okay, go ahead.
You were the clerk of courts for a long time. I mean, the upside of the defense of people on Beacon Hill is that this is how it works. You expect someone to stand out in the summer and the sun with a sign, I want John Nucci to be whatever John Nucci's running for. It's not crazy to expect some kind of payback for that you call. And I'm sure, John Nucci, you were deluged with people wanting to be court officers.
Yeah.
I mean, so what was your rule of thumb?
Yeah. Well, I didn't hire court
officers. Because you were, of course,
officers.
not indicted.
Right. I didn't hire court officers. Those were hired by the trial.
But you must have gotten
calls. But I know what you mean. I know exactly what you mean. I think what's come out of this whole thing is that nobody is really saying that patronage is illegal.
Yeah.
What was found to be illegal was the jury found a rigged hiring system. The documents were falsified and turned it into mail fraud and racketeering and everything else, which, you know, they worked hard on this and they came up with that verdict. It's always going to be the case that people recommend, elected officials recommend, you know what, business leaders recommend. When you're in a public office, you don't just get calls from speakers of the House or presidents of the Senate. You get calls from business leaders. You get calls from clergy.
Yeah, but do you recommend people, John Nucci, do you recommend people who have a heroin problem, who a judge on the panel testified was woefully unqualified, like one of Terry Murray, Senate president's nominees? I mean, my attitude is, well, obviously I care about the criminal justice system. Guilty or not guilty, indicted or not indicted is almost secondary to me.
Right.
There were some decisions made here about forwarding some individual names that are just unconscionable.
But the wrongdoing is with the source, the recipient of the name. If once they receive that name, they move it to the top of the pile inappropriately or undeservedly. The problem is not with a state representative or a speaker of the House.
John, I am sorry. When you have a budget that the legislature approves or disapproves and the Senate president sends over a name, what are you going to say? I'm sorry, Madam President, I'm not interested in your candidate. Let's change gears for a second if we can. My attitude is, if Charlie Baker had a dream a month ago, his dream would be, please give me a probation verdict, even if there are no – this is a dream come true for this guy. Is it not, Michael Astro?
I agree with that. I think it's interesting how it cuts for the others. I think it's problematic for Martha Coakley. She's viewed as the establishment candidate.
Yeah, but she indicted and tried the guy. She lost, but she did try. She did bring him up on charges.
No,
she, the original trial against John O'Brien was Martha Coakley inspired. But I'm sorry, go ahead.
But I think it's a problem for Berwick as well, because if you're trying to say the state should take over health care and take it away from Harvard Pilgrim and Tufts and that kind of thing, you say, well, What does it look like in state government? Well, it looks like the probation department. It looks like the connector, which is the only state agency that hasn't complied with Obamacare. The labor department can't run unemployment insurance. The pharmacy commission can't regulate appropriately, people die all over the country. So we're going to take this quality state government, and that's going to be running your health insurance. I think it's a problem for him as well.
Go ahead, John.
I actually agree that this is a plus for Charlie Baker. I think I wrote a column in the Herald months
ago
that said he would be writing as a Mr. Fix-It, that he'd be the guy who'd be out there saying lots of things are broken. I'm the guy that can fix it. So in that sense, I think it helps Charlie Baker. I don't think it hurts the Democrats. I don't think people see patronage as exclusively a Democratic issue. Everybody knows that if there's going to be a Republican governor, there's probably going to continue to be patronage under a Republican governor too. So I don't think it hurts the Democrats. I do think it helps Baker.
So how do you do this, John Nucci? I mean, find that balance? Because it's clear whether people were indicted or not, that the sins were way beyond just, recommending a nice person with a good resume that was qualified to hold your sign and give that person a job. So what do you do? Do we need to have new rules here?
You absolutely do. You know, I think this may sound like I'm looking at it through rose-colored glasses or I'm naive, but I don't think anybody up at the State House knows where that line is in terms of what's right and what's wrong when you're asked to recommend somebody for a job.
Yep.
There are some folks up there who legitimately think if they get a call from a business leader or a clergy or somebody that says, gee, can you help Billy get a job in the probation department, that dashing off a letter to the probation department is right or wrong. I don't think they know whether it is or it isn't. So, you know, I think this was the test case that showed, okay, this is right, this is wrong. This starts to define the line. I think we're probably going to need to define that line more. I've heard people quoted in the press who are holding public office now saying, I'm not writing another letter until we find out what's right and what's wrong.
And by the way, in all fairness, the reform that was passed after the Ware report came out and after the Globe Spotlight series does include the disclosure of any recommendation letters coming from legislators. So not exactly the same thing could happen again.
But so obviously, Senate President Terry Murray, when you're recommending someone that had a heroin problem, that probably isn't the way to go.
Well, assuming you know there's a heroin problem, and how are we going to determine whether somebody knows somebody has a heroin problem? There's an assumption you should know that, but maybe you don't. So, you know, either we're going to make writing letters for people illegal and stop them from happening,
yep,
or you're going to have this trickle through where these things happen every once in a while.
We're talking to Michael Astro. You've served in four presidential administrations. How old are you? I mean, really? Reagan, Bush, and Obama, correct?
Right. And I'm 57.
Wow. Wonder
kid. He was a prodigy.
And John Nucci, former school committee member, former city councilor, and now he works at Suffolk University. Every time there's an immigration flare-up in Massachusetts, I'm surprised. Not because of the substance of the issue. It's sort of my subliminal mindset, Michael Astro, is that doesn't happen here. This is not a Massachusetts issue. So were you surprised by the ferocity of the response from those? It was a protest rally at the State House over the weekend by those who do not support what Deval Patrick says he's doing, saying I'm welcoming up to 1,000 kids at these two military bases?
Not when I looked at it, because I think the governor handled this extremely badly. It seems to me that what's driving this is what will make President Obama happy. His talking points, I looked and checked, are almost the same as Rahm Emanuel's in Chicago, whereas you go to Bill de Blasio in New York, it's very different. He says, we've got immigrants, we'll see. And so you got this very abrupt, poorly put together proposal to just put as many people as possible, like we had another Katrina. And that has inflamed people, and it's distracted from what should be the question, which should be, what's best for these children? What kind of environment? Because the reality is, once we sign up for this duty, whether he'll admit it or not, we're in this for the long haul.
So what is best for these children? I bet you've thought about it.
Thought about it. One is you have to try to figure out, and I don't know that they've been able to do this because I think the Obama administration's handling of this has been abrupt and sloppy as well. Who are these children? How do they break down? You know, they're not one generic stereotype. Mm-hmm. You've got more girls coming across the border than we've seen before. You've got some kids who have been involved with gangs. You've got some who are primarily coming over for economic purposes. There's a lot of difference between a 12-year-old and a 17-year-old. And it is also true that if you do what the governor suggested we do, which is you warehouse these kids in large facilities, I mean, if you asked what would be most likely to turn them to crime and disrespect for America. That's it. And so it seems to me we should be trying to figure out how to, if we're going to sign up for this duty, I'm not opposed to signing up for this duty, how do you do it well? How do you partner? There's been no discussion with partners. I mean, one of the partners should be the Catholic Church. You know, there's some penance to be done locally when it comes to children. They've got underused facilities. A lot of these children are Catholic. Maybe they can help. You know, there are, you know, we should be asking these kinds of questions rather than saying, you know, let's respond if it's as if it's Katrina, because it's not.
You know, one of the interesting things for me, John Nucci, is because Charlie Baker said, despite the fact that when he ran last time, David Bernstein pointed this out, and I thought an excellent blog that he did on his Boston Magazine site, is while on virtually every immigrant issue, on in-state tuition for the kids of illegal immigrants, driver's licenses, secure communities, he was trashing Deval Patrick 4 years ago, he has embraced this with some reservations. I want to make sure how it's going to be paid for, what the logistics are going to be, etc. So does that at least calm the tensions on this thing, or is this going to be huge come through the fall?
No, I think there's a lot of anger out there. I think Charlie Baker made a political decision not to offer a knee-jerk response. I think everybody probably expected the Republican candidate for governor to come out with his teeth bared and say, this is terrible, this is awful, you know, we can't do it. I think he made a political decision because we all know in this particular election cycle, he's been working very hard to sort of soften his edges, to not be that angry Republican that got him into trouble, I think, last time against Deval Patrick. You know, I think the rage and the agonizing over whether these children should be housed at this base or that base or at any base at all, it's kind of like the captain of the Titanic deciding whether he should grab an orange life preserver or a white life preserver. You know, it's not the problem. The problem is far more systemic than that, and that is that the federal government has not come up with a solution to this bigger problem. And I think, you know, what it's unfortunate that there's so much anger in Massachusetts right now. I agree. I think Governor Patrick did not handle this well at all. I think he was a little bit tone deaf again in terms of how he seemed to be lecturing the people of Massachusetts, that somehow if you're not for this, if you don't get on board with this, you're inhumane, you know, comparing it to the Holocaust.
Yeah, that was highly unfortunate.
Yeah, you know,
and then there's the deceptive hyper-precision in the rhetoric. So the assurance that these children would only be here on an average of 35 days, there's no way that he can make that representation and guarantee. That's just really unconscionable.
By the way, fellow Democrat Marty Walsh, who has now made positive comments, who totally agrees with you, Michael, as true, and says it's not going to be that. Speaking of, this is
talking about open arms. I mean, into the schools and everything else is what where Marty
if
Walsh
is. If they stay,
is.
Yeah.
Yes, and he's got three of the city councilors with him on that agenda, which that is one of the big areas that people are upset about is how are the schools going to afford these kinds of things? He's
saying, especially after they just cut the school budget by X number, dozens and dozens of positions, right?
But do you think Marty Walsh is any more effective in his embrace of these kids and teenagers than Deval Patrick?
Absolutely. I mean, if I have to pick between the two, I am. I mean, Jim's right. I'm a lot closer to Marty Walsh, at least. I mean, I probably would have some disagreements if we talk long enough, but I think he's at least thinking about it, you know, the right way. He's accepting that, you know, there's a moral commitment for Massachusetts to do its fair share federally. I get that. I support that. And you need to be thinking about this as a long-term commitment, what's right for the communities and what's right for the children. And I don't think Deval Patrick is on that term at all. It's just, let's find the biggest warehouses, and that shows the greatest support for Barack Obama. And I think that's horrible.
Incidentally, Marty Walsh will be with us for an hour in studio tomorrow from noon to one. So if you want to talk to the mayor about exactly this issue or anything else, he'll be with us. This is a small thing, but it put me over the edge. As a former city councilor, one of the city councilors who's troubled by this is the president of the city council, which is perfectly fine, Bill Linehan, who, if you recall, ended up in Ireland for St. Patrick's Day. Apparently, it was a conflict. But putting that aside, maybe it was Linda Dorsino Forey was the conflict. But putting that aside, I'm reading the Herald today, and I'm reading to the paragraph where Linehan has his response, and a city councilor in Boston's response is given by his spokesperson, George Regan, one of the most prominent PRP. Did you have a spokesperson when you were on the city council or president of the school committee?
I picked up the phone myself and talked to reporters.
Do you find that to be, I'll tell you something, it drives me out of my mind. It is so disrespectful.
First, let me tell you one thing. You were probably one of the only people who did, because it's been my experience as a reporter to get through to a school committee member in Boston, to get through a city council person. It's like you have to go through 17
they
rings.
They have paid spokespeople who are not on their staff?
They have paid spokespeople who are on their staff. George Regan is a new threshold passed. I didn't know there were also paid spokespeople outside. But I would say, in general, the city council is well insulated from the inquiries of the local reporters.
She used to return her phone calls when you were a city councilor?
Always. He's great, but he is unusual. When he was on city council, he was unusual.
One last thing before we switch to international deals. I every week on this political segment that opens our Monday show, I grow wildly concerned by the fact that there seems to be virtually no attention paid to any of these statewide races. Maybe it's because this casino ballot question, and maybe there's a little to the governor's race. But I got an email from, I don't think he wants me to disclose, one of the people running for lieutenant governor on the Democratic side over the weekend. And he said, would you moderate a debate of the lieutenant governor candidates, because there aren't any scheduled. So the guy on the Democratic side who is going to be the nominee, guy or woman, I don't know if there are women running, on the Democratic side, who is going to be the nominee to run with whoever the gubernatorial nominee is, the election is 6 days, eight days after Labor Day. Is this not a problem when they're essentially people are going to be going into this totally blind, Michael Astrew?
I think it is. And I think it's a symptom. First of all, nationally, I think there's fatigue about politics and political bickering. I think here in Massachusetts, where we had a number of very close bidder races together, an unusual number of them, I think it's even a little bit greater. And I have been surprised. I mean, usually, you know, interesting elections are like sports events in Massachusetts growing up. And this is not that way. I think very few people are paying attention. And there's almost no attention below the governor's race, from what I can see.
Yeah, there's only so much oxygen in the room.
But
there's just none left for these undercard races. Now, don't forget, we have a governor's race. We've had the raging casino debate that went on for months and months and still going on.
Three other ballot questions.
The ballot question that will give that debate even more energy as we get closer.
We have a United States senator running for re-election, Ed Markey, which virtually nobody knows.
Exactly. Well, Jim, the Globe just did a whole piece about why we even need a lieutenant governor, so maybe we're getting frenzy over something that doesn't even matter. We're talking with Mike Astrew. He's a Republican who served as Commissioner of the Social Security Administration under many presidents. John Nucci is a Boston Herald columnist and Vice President of Government Relations and Community Affairs at Suffolk University, which brings us to your outside lives a little bit. It isn't really your outside life because you're at Suffolk University when you're not.
A little interlude here.
At the Herald.
Okay.
A little interlude, though, because I have seen these terrific ads on TV that are running for Suffolk University. Here is one of them. And this is a scene from On the Waterfront, one of the classic movies with Marlon Brando. Here it is.
You was my brother, Charlie. You should have looked out for me a little bit. You should have taken care of me just a little bit so I wouldn't have to take them dives for the short end money.
Well, I had some bets down for you. You saw some money.
You don't understand. I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody instead of a bum.
And then the big Suffolk University.
Now,
of course, I'm sure you're not implying everybody doesn't go to Suffolk University. It's a bum. But tell us the effect of those ads, because they're quite cleverly done.
The fact that we're sitting here talking about it is one of the effects of that ad. And I think that's important. You know, we want people to know what Suffolk University is. Now, don't forget, Suffolk University has a long history of having a mission of opportunity and access. You know, we have been the place for years that's been the commuter school up until very, very recently, where lots of people earn their degree that might not have gotten to the front door of other universities because they were able to go at night, part-time, and the types of things that we offered that let them get that degree that maybe they couldn't have gotten anywhere else. Not because there are lower academic standards, but because we provide access, different ways of access to the university so that you can earn a degree.
I didn't even know Marlon Brando went there, by the way. I was really shocked.
He did.
Right. So that's sort of the message, I think, of this, is that, you know, there are other ads in this series to talk about, you know, it's not a birthright to go to college. It's a privilege. There are suggestions that we want hardworking
students. I think the ads are good. I think they're really good.
Yeah.
And the passion ads are good, too. Okay, we had an interlude for him. We're going to have one for you. Okay. You ever heard of this guy, Michael Astrew? You probably haven't. A.M. Juster. You ever heard of this guy?
I have.
Who is this character? Who is he?
I started about 25 years ago writing poetry under a pseudonym and translation. And I got outed about 4 years ago.
Were you upset by that?
I was.
Why?
Because I liked my privacy. I didn't feel it was anyone else's business, and I was quite happy that way.
Are you going to be aggravated when I tell you that, you know, you've, again, served four presidents of the United States, pretty opinionated character. Yeah. You've been a high-tech CEO. I mean, you've done... And when I read your poetry, in fact, I brought one. Would you read it if I love this. Oh, come on. No, just quit. Come on. Here's a poem. It's called Packing Up on... I love this poem. Packing Up on Labor Day. It's by A.M. Juster, also known as Michael Astor. Go ahead, read the thing. Come on. Here it is. Here he is, Michael Astor, reading as his other self.
All right.
Okay, don't blow this, will you, please? Go ahead. Go ahead.
Packing Up on Labor Day. The telltale maple bordering the field flushes with yellow joy at breaking ranks and calls for new defections from the fold. For now, the leaves withhold their citrus angst. New shoots of grass obscure the road's long ruts, and birches balance on their nest of roots. Our checklist hammers out its tired score. We stuff the garbage can. We scrub the sinks. We leave the grants another note of thanks. Despite my back, I drag the backs out where the van is yawning like a zoo-bored beast. As children ravage ragweed and wildflowers, I try to memorize the meadow's crest, then curse the most uncertain of desires.
I think it's great. I really think that's
very good.
That really is terrific. Thank you for reading it.
Well, I should probably credit my mother-in-law because that all got started from the phrase "the telltale maple," which I'd never heard before. But my mother-in-law used that. We were up in Vermont in the house they used to have up there, and that kicked off that sonnet.
It's terrific.
So how'd you get outed?
I don't even really know. There's a guy that runs an angry Social Security blog who
and if you didn't hear, you were the former commissioner of Social Security, for those who don't know.
He tore into me. He's still tearing into me all the time. And he somehow got the story. I don't know how he got it. But he was relatively polite about it, which stunned me.
Okay, it's hard to go from a reading of Packing Up on Labor Day to Dan Pfeiffer. Dan Pfeiffer is a senior Obama aide. He was at a Christian Science Monitor event last Friday in D.C. First, he talked about a possible executive order, a sweeping one on immigration, maybe coming the end of the summer. Then he spoke about the prospect of presidential impeachment. Here's Pfeiffer.
Tremendously frustrated that Congress won't act. And taking executive action along the lines of what the president talked about when he was in the Rose Garden a few weeks ago would allow us to redirect resources to the border to deal with this. We take it very seriously, and I don't think it would be a good thing. But I think it would be foolish to discount the possibility that Republicans will at least consider going down that path at some point in the future.
Okay, that is Dan Pfeiffer again, key Obama. The rumors are that at the end of we've all heard the president saying, if Congress won't act on X, Y, or Z, then I will do what I can as an executive order. There are reports over this weekend that by the end of the summer, he is going to issue a sweeping executive order, not just dealing with these kids, which is a whole separate issue as far as I think a lot of us are concerned, but is potentially affecting as many as 4 or 5 million adults. First of all, what's your reaction to that in light of the fact that Congress is doing nothing? And secondly, what do you think the repercussions are for the president and the country, Michael Astor?
Well, I have a position that probably only one person in the entire country has. And this is coming largely from my experience as a former general counsel at HHS, where you're defending the decisions of the secretary, even when they're often regrettable. And so one of the things I became quite fluent with, the Supreme Court case called Heckler versus Cheney, which basically does give the president very wide latitude in terms of interpreting most statutes, if you do it right and you do it carefully. But it does still require you to go through rulemaking, to make fact findings, and there is an opportunity for the public to be involved in that in most cases. And so I'm not, with a lot of my Republicans, say he can't exercise executive discretion. I may be wrong, but I'm consistent. When I represented Republican secretaries, I said they had a wide amount of discretion. Obama's appointees do too. My beef is they are using it badly and sloppily, and executive orders really generally are not the tool for doing that. Notice and comment rulemaking, where there is that opportunity for public participation, changing of mistakes, this I'm not going to deal with anyone. I'm just going to write what I want and direct it.
So you think he may be able to do something on a big scale, but this isn't the vehicle
for
that.
Right. I think he's doing it badly is what I'm thinking. And in terms of the ramifications, I know that there's been talk about impeachment for several years now. It's a little bit larger than before, but I don't think it's going to happen. I think Boehner is right. He's showing leadership. It would be a dumb thing for the House Republicans to do, and I don't think it's going to happen.
Quick thing on this, John Nucci. Assuming he does it, and obviously it's going to be cast in the context, as I said before, of Congress won't act, and I know you want immigration reform, which a majority of Americans do, so I'm going to do it. It seems to me that the blowback from that in the midterm elections, which are already sketchy for Democrats, particularly in the United States Senate, has potential to be immense. Well, some might argue, well, they're going to like the Democrats because they're actually doing something. Where do you fall in this?
I mean, I think people who don't like Obama, don't like what he's doing, are going to say it's further evidence that he's trying to turn the country into a dictatorship and he's doing these kinds of things. I think those who tend to support Obama are going to say, well, this is what leadership is all about. When Congress does an act, the president does. Doing it by executive order is probably going to be very, very difficult to come up with an airtight case that's not going to be challenged legally and come all apart. But I think for that moment, when and if he announces some broad sweeping order about dealing with this problem, I think the impact is going to be overall very, very positive for the president and the Democrats.
We're talking with John Nucci and Michael Astrew. I find it funny that Obama's a tyrant domestically, but he's a wuss internationally. Yeah. It's sort of really interesting, the criticism. But in any case, I want to ask you, Michael, we'll start with you anyway, two conflicting court decisions last week about Obamacare. Yeah. One saying the subsidies are illegal, the other kind of saying just the opposite. But it makes people very nervous about the long-term viability of Obamacare. What are we to make of these conflicting court decisions?
Well, whether or not the D.C. Decision holds up, and it's going to be on bank. It's a majority of Democratic appointees. It would not surprise me if it were reversed when the full D.C. Circuit hears it. There are other challenges in the 7th and 10th Circuits, and the case is strong enough that I do think that they'll win somewhere, the challengers, and that it will go to the Supreme Court, and I would think probably next year.
When you say they, the challengers, you mean those who say that the subsidies are only available if you have a state exchange like Massachusetts does, not like two-thirds of the state that use the federal exchange.
Right. And it's not a slam dunk. The court that ruled in the administration's favor actually had to use a legal theory different from what the administration put forward because what they put forward didn't really hold up. And it goes back to my general point. When IRS did this, it was abrupt. It was without sort of rulemaking and that type of thing. So there's not much for the courts to defer to. I think, if I'd been general counsel at the IRS and you'd given me 3 months to do this right, I could have written it in a way that would stand court challenge. But they didn't do it. They did it, as I said before, sloppy, abrupt, lack of participation. And what that means is it's a lot less likely to hold up.
But even if it's sloppy and abrupt and without participation, as Michael just said, John Nucci, I think politically for the Republicans, it's really bad to take away from people something that they already have had and enjoyed, like insurance for your 22 and 23-year-olds, because the reality is they're not going to be able to pick and choose what they like if they get rid of the whole baby with the bathwater.
Yeah, if you're putting this into political terms, though, this debate over health care and Obamacare was raging. It was red hot a few months ago. It's been taken over by the immigration debate. It's sort of on the political radar. It's almost slipped back below immigration as a debate. There's this funny thing that happens in politics, I think, when things wind up in the courts and the discussion turns to the courts. I think voters and people who watch politics say, all right, the courts will set it off. What else can we be mad about? And move on to something else. I think there might be a feeling right now that the courts will sort this out. Those who are rooting for Obama will say it'll be fine. Those who are rooting against Obama will say now we'll see just how bad this all has been. So I think it's sort of slipped away politically. I agree with you. Taking stuff away is never a good thing. So this might backfire on the Republicans. But I think right now it's not right up front on the screen for most average voters.
Okay. Michael Astor, thank you very much for coming in here today. Mike Astor was a Republican, served as the commissioner of the Social Security Administration. John Nucci is a Boston Herald columnist and vice president of government relations and community affairs at Suffolk, with those great ads and the great poetry. It was nice to talk to you both, and thank you for coming in. Up next, we do not have cameras in the courtroom, but we're getting them in our school buses. Big Brother on Wheels is next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
I'm Bob C. Tomorrow on WGBH's Morning Edition, Attorney General Martha Coakley joins us for the next conversation in our Tuesday Meet the Gubernatorial Candidate series. That's tomorrow only on WGBH's Morning Edition.
The WGBH Food and Wine Chef's Gala, an elegant evening of fine foods paired with fantastic wines. And when you support WGBH with a gift of $300 right now, we'll say thanks with a pair of tickets. More at wgbh.org/festival.
Funding for our programs comes from you and Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick, a law firm with a national practice focused on long-term disability, life insurance, and veterans benefits. You can find Chisholm, Chisholm & Kilpatrick online at cck-law.com. And Tanglewood, the summer home of the BSO, presenting new Tanglewood Tales, backstage with rising artists, a web series that reveals the real-life stories about musicians pursuing the world of classical music. Tanglewood.org/tales.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. The Boston School Department is outfitting all 750 school buses with audio and video surveillance equipment. The idea is they'll be used to crack down on discipline issues such as bullying, but is Big Brother the bully in this scenario? Will adding surveillance equipment make students feel threatened? Could it be used to discipline kids who are behaving badly or to discipline kids who are just, I don't know, being kids? 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. Are cameras a good idea, or is it intrusion into the basic rights of privacy of these kids? You know, my reaction to this is a solution in search of a problem. They basically say, I'm not saying bullying's not an issue, but they basically, the guy who's in charge of this thing, says there haven't been a ton of serious issues on incidents on the buses. And if there aren't, and you're spending $1 million over 4 years right after you're laying off teachers and school administrators, why are they doing this thing? Are you in favor of this?
No, I'm not in favor of it, but we may be in the minority, Jim. I'm just getting the first three Facebook postings we had are all in favor. Paula says it's long overdue. Now when you have naughty boys and girls act up, you have it on tape. Not sure it will change anyone's behavior, but let's hope it will. Ben says, I'm actually surprised this is new. When I was a high school student in Webster in the late 90s, there were cameras on the buses. School buses are public property. Students that ride them are considered to be on school grounds. No problem with surveillance. So maybe we're in a minority. I don't like it. I don't like the – I mean, I guess I get the and I don't like it for the driver, frankly, either. You know, there's nothing like having your boss literally looking over your shoulder. In this
one
case,
camera's trained on the driver,
yeah,
one on the passenger.
And just make sure the driver's behaving and make sure that the kids are behaving. You know, it is terrible that we cannot afford monitors on the bus, like regular people to be on the bus to make sure the kids behave. Although there was that terrible story about the monitor that was brutalized by the kids
years
on the bus.
Years ago, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm just not big on cameras watching and listening, and they'll be doing both in this case. The number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. The ACLU, of course, is opposed to this, thinks it's a bad idea. The Anti-Defamation League is in favor of it because they think it's going to help prevent the kind of bullying and misbehavior that many kids have reported going on buses.
So why not put a – you know, the problem with this is, will it – is it likely it will prevent something? Probably it will, because there's a big sign that says there's a camera and audio equipment on the bus, so most kids, unless they're total morons, are probably going to refrain from bullying activity until there's not a camera. Why not put a camera everywhere then? I mean, obviously, camera everywhere is going to make it less likely you do that sort of stuff too. The part of this that drives – did you read the part in the Globe story where if there is an incident, the bus driver, who doesn't have enough to do, presses a button and the video is automatically sent, emailed or something – to transportation officials who will view this thing. I mean, is that not Big Brother? And by the way, in all fairness to the transportation types in Boston, Marty Walsh will be here tomorrow. We'll talk to him about this too. They're saying there will not be ongoing monitoring only if there's a problem. I mean, if you believe that, I've got a you-know-what to say. I mean, it's just wrong.
Now, some would say that there is the other – remember the old story about the Silver Lake Regional High School?
Oh, yes, I do. Be careful with this story.
Where the kids were in the back of the bus doing what you might think that kids would be doing in the back of the bus, and the parents could not believe this is going on in the back of the bus. Maybe you might be inhibited from doing those sorts of things, you know, boys and girls in the back of the bus type of stuff.
No, but Sarah, this is like you're guilty until proven innocent.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I mean, imagine if how you would feel at your job if your boss had a camera over your desk to make sure you were, you know, not making any personal phone calls or not surfing the internet for, you know, for Zappos shoes or something. It just assumes that you're doing your – so it's very insulting to the drivers. And I think it's kind of creepy in terms of the kids. But again, so far, the Facebook postings, we'll see what the emailers and the callers think that it's not a bad idea. 877-301-8978. Let's start. Is it Mela from Boston? Did I pronounce it right?
Hi, Mela.
It's very insulting to the drivers.
You got to turn your radio down. Mela, we'll put you on hold. We'll get back to you in a minute. Let's go up to Newburyport, where Bob is on Boston Public Radio. Hey there, Bob.
Yes. Hi, Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for having me on.
Pleasure.
I would raise the question of if you're really worried about kids being safe on school buses, why do school buses still not have seatbelts?
We've had this discussion for years, but go ahead.
Yeah, if we're going to spend this kind of money, it would seem to me that the first priority, if we really are concerned about children's safety, is to require all school buses to have seatbelts. And I think the whole camera thing, while it might be set up to indicate a need to monitor bullying, maybe for other purposes.
Like what?
I don't know, you know, weapons or something like that, you know, what kids are bringing on. I'm not sure, but I mean, if we're going to talk about safety, I think we need to talk about seatbelts.
By the way, just on the seatbelt front, I'm not saying I agree with this. Marty and I have asked school officials that question over the years, and the uniform response is, and you don't have to accept it, I'm just telling you what most school officials say, is if they're seatbelted in, particularly younger kids, would have trouble getting off a bus if there was a fire or some sort of serious thing. So they say, comparing risk, it's getting off the bus is a more important thing than being safeguarded in your seat. I don't know if it's true. That's what we hear. Bob, thank you for the call.
Well, they also say that there's something about the way bus seats are built that makes them less dangerous. But I have to say, I'm suspicious. I think it's probably about money. And once again, I mean,
well, this is about money too.
You know, wouldn't you rather have a monitor? I mean, wouldn't you want
to
have?
Well, they can't afford it. It's $275,000 a year. They're not going to get They're not going to get 750 school buses worth of monitors for $275,000
a year. They used to have monitors.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I think it's where you want to put your money. 877-301-8970.
You know, it also sends.
What?
It also the message it sends to kids that we're going to watch you all the
time. I know.
And I know the response is well. It'll make it less likely that bad actors are doing bad acting. I understand that, but you can't regulate everything. Some things you may have to deal with after the fact. And then, by the way, I would feel totally differently if the transportation coordinator for Boston was saying, we've had a score of serious bullying incidents on buses in the last year, then that's one thing. But this is, again, it's a preemptive thing that I think is overreaching. What
Christopher just emailed and said, what's next? Someone from the TSA doing pat-downs?
Well, by the way, that's not only is it not funny. They have metal detectors at some urban high schools, which is the equivalent of a
pat down. Well, that there's two sides of that one though. You have a lot of the kids that say they feel better with them. I think they're creepy. It makes you think, oh my god, I have to be so afraid.
It's like you're going to prison instead of going to school.
But I think unfortunately, kids do bring weapons into school in some of these very tough high schools, and maybe their classmates feel better. I don't know. I could argue either way on that one. Let's go to Parker in Newton. Hi, Parker. What do you think?
Hi. I think in general, it is important to be really scrutinizing about where we're introducing cameras and how much we're watching kids. But I have to say, the back of the bus, I'm 31 now. I remember well the days of grade school, and the things that go on in the back of the bus can be terrifying. I mean, not only physical bullying, but just emotional torture on some levels at times. And I would be shocked if we actually had a grasp on how much bullying is going on in the back of the bus these days. And I, you know, I'm surprised to hear myself come down on this side of the line, because normally I would be in favor of less, you know, video surveillance. And I think it's an entirely different matter to video the driver of a bus versus the kid. You know, I think that has to be considered separately. But
Maybe Parker, we have in the last five rows, have the camera.
Honestly,
for the last five rows.
I think that wouldn't be unwise. The last five rows, a lot still on.
Yeah.
There.
The goody two shoes are up in the front of the bus, and the little hooligans are in the back of the bus.
I grew up on Cape Cod in a small, you know, little town with, you know, a sweet little population, and horrifying things were happening on the back of school buses. It, you know, with 6 and 7 and 8 and 9 year olds. So
no, it's true. You know, I have friends whose kids wear glasses and they're on the bus. I mean, my nephew for a long, he's grown up now, but he was going through a pair of glasses a week practically because they were all taking his glasses and stepping on his glasses. The poor kid, it was terrible. Not to mention his poor parents who had to keep replacing them.
Parker, thanks for the call. So if you sound like you agree with Parker and you talk about your nephew, then why aren't you in favor of this?
Because I just don't like the Big Brother thing of every. I don't in general like the idea of assuming that everybody's doing something wrong, and to me that's what this is.
But that's by the way, that's what thousands of cameras on the street, which I know you support, are doing. Essentially, we are in a culture, and I'm surprised you're not saying what you often say when we talk about NSA mm-hmm. things. And you say the credit card companies have all this information, the internet companies have all this information. The reality is, unfortunately, everywhere you turn, there is a camera that is filming.
I know,
I don't mean a private sector camera. I mean a public sector camera.
These are children. And I guess the idea, you know, if you think about raising your own children, you want to impart the idea that you trust your children until they give you a reason to distrust them. And that's the problem with this. You're saying you're all little hooligans. You're all going to be misbehaving. And we're going to watch you and listen to everything you say from the time you get on the bus, the time you get to school. It just creeps me out. But maybe I'm mistaken. Davis from Worcester. What do you think, Davis?
Hi, Davis. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Excellent. Thank you.
So Worcester has had cameras on buses for a long time now. And as a teacher, they're invaluable for when you have a parent call the school and say, you know, this is happening on the bus to my student, my child. And you avoid all the he said, she said, because you can go to the person that, you know, the parent said is involved, and they're like, oh, no, that didn't happen. And then you pull the camera tape, and you're like, well, it did happen. And then you can prove to the other parent, look, this is what your child is doing on the bus, and these are the consequences of it. I mean, I hate the whole Big Brother thing, but, you know, for our kids and their safety on the buses, it works for us.
Davis, how many kids in your class? What do you teach, first of all?
Second grade.
And how many kids in your class?
My classrooms range from 15 to 28.
Well, so, and that's a pretty tough job. So one can make the same argument, since it's pretty hard to keep track. It's the ultimate herding cats things, 28 second graders. Why shouldn't we put a camera in your classroom as well, so that when your back is turned or something, you're preoccupied with something else, where we can be certain when a parent complains, the same way you just described about the bus. I don't think you want a camera in your classroom, do you?
Why would it bother me? I don't do anything wrong in my class.
No. But Davis, that's like, Marjorie's often said the same thing to me. That's like saying, then let's put a camera in everybody's house. And then we don't have to worry if you're not doing anything wrong there. What's the difference? But in case you're making, you have weapons or something, we'll be able to monitor. There's a line, and it seems to me, and again, you're in the profession, so you probably know much more about what you're talking about than I do. Having a camera in a kid's classroom because you're concerned about behavior is just, I'm sort of into the human-to-human thing, even if you occasionally miss something, you know?
A camera in the classroom, now, I'm not saying that I want a camera in the classroom, but mm-hmm. a camera in the classroom isn't for behavior for the students. I know teachers, and I've done it myself, where you actually film what happens in your classroom. And it's not for like watching what the kids are doing. It's watching what you're doing. And you can say to yourself, like, okay,
oh, well, that's...
here's, I did during the day, and this is what I need to do to change.
That's a different story. I hear that. And if that's the purpose, to improve your, at least assess your own teaching skills, and your, that's fine. All I'm saying, and I'm sort of where Marjorie, it's sort of creepy to me that we're telling kids at a young age, essentially, that we don't trust them. And I worry that that has an impact on how they relate to the world for, frankly, for the rest of their lives. Davis, though, thank you for sharing your experiences. We appreciate it.
Dave from Upton. What do you think, Dave?
Hey, Dave.
I think it is all about money when it comes to having video. I mean, it's there now. I'm a school bus driver. So if there was somebody else there to monitor the behavior of the kid, you wouldn't really need this.
Yep.
But the driver has to drive. There's only so much the driver can do monitoring the behavior of those kids.
So you think it would be a good thing?
Well, it's already there, and it's used now. If the ones, and the ones that behave don't really have anything to worry about.
Yeah.
You know, the ones that misbehave. So it really is necessary if there's not going to be a monitor on the bus.
Dave, did you ever have a monitor on your bus?
Well, not on the bus. I drive vans that have monitors.
Okay.
And, you know, it's a whole, I mean, I do different kinds of driving. Sometimes there's nobody there. Sometimes, like on a field trip, there are chaperones there. So, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean, Jim pointed out that it's a lot more expensive to have the monitors, and I'm sure it is. You have to pay them, you know, pay them in benefits and the whole kind of thing. But it just seems to me creepy. How would you feel about having the – is the camera watching you already? Or is that
it's
not –
It's already there, yeah.
It's already there. And how do you feel about that?
Well, like I said, for us it's invaluable because if you're going to do something wrong, you'll think twice knowing that there's a camera there.
Okay.
Hey, Dave, thank you for the call. We really convinced a lot of people. I think it's really...
Well, apparently...
Can I tell you what I think this is?
Apparently we are wrong on this one, at least according to the callers, the emailers, and the Facebook posters.
We've had a lot of discussions through the years, you and I on the air, and I'm sure everybody else listening has had these discussions too, about how the world changed in many ways that weren't obvious to all of us on 9/11.
Right.
And we all became far more willing to have intrusive, invasive kinds of things like cameras.
Yep.
I have to say, I think it's an extension of this thing. I don't believe that 20 years ago, the response would be as uniformly on Facebook, callers saying it's fine, you know, to prevent things. I think the feeling would be that we and our kids are entitled to a certain level of privacy, and this crosses the line. It makes me nervous because all this stuff, I hate the expression slippery slope, but I can't think of another one. It's all slippery slope stuff. You basically accept it here, then you accept it everywhere. There's a camera everywhere you go, and I don't like that kind of thing.
I don't think they're going to be in your house anytime soon, Jim. So you can continue to slither around in your house and no one will know.
You always say that, and thank
you
for
you
for that dispensation. I appreciate it. But would you ever have thought, you quoted the statistic, and it's out of date by a few years. 4 or 5 years ago in London, every single person was caught on camera 300 times plus. It's probably 1,000 now. I don't know what it is.
Brush your hair.
If I had said to you 15 years ago that would happen, you'd say it's never. They're never going to be filming you. They're never going to put a. The bottom line is, I don't know what's coming next, but it's more and more and more.
But one last thing.
There's no ability.
Those are in public places, those cameras. They're on the subway, they're on corners. I guess a bus is a public place. It is a public place.
It is a public place,
I guess.
It
but
is.
Somehow, because it's enclosed, I don't know, it seems a little bit different to me. Anyway, we have to move on. Because,
We have another bus driver on the phone
We do? Oh, we'll take the other bus driver before we go.
Well, who's that?
I don't know.
Oh, we just had the bus driver.
Yeah, we just had the
bus
driver.
In any case, thank you all for the calls.
Okay.
We haven't resolved this.
We're going to be joined up
next. But we should say, Marty Walsh is going to be here tomorrow. It's one of the other things we'll broach with him.
Yeah.
Is because obviously this is the 750 school buses in Boston.
Well, that's the word, you know, that Marty Walsh spent his childhood in the back of the bus carrying on. So we'll find out if that's true when he's here tomorrow.
Will.
Up next, though, it is time for All Revved Up with the Reverends Irene Monroe and Emmett Price. Stay tuned for that on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
When it comes to population growth, Massachusetts is outpacing the rest of New England. And according to Governor Deval Patrick, that's cause for celebration.
It's great in a commonwealth to have newcomers who are choosing to be here. And I think with that newness comes talent and energy and ideas that make us stronger.
But growth can also bring headaches and debates about whether bigger is necessarily better. I'm reporter Adam Riley, and I'll discuss Massachusetts' growing pains this afternoon on WGBH's All Things Considered.
Support for our programs comes from you.
And Newbury Court, a full-service residential community for persons over the age of 62. Newbury Court in Concord, Massachusetts. You can schedule a visit any day of the week by visiting newburycourt.org.
and Harvard Extension School, offering courses in data science, software development, and digital media. Registration through September 1st. More information available online at extension.harvard.edu.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brody and Marjorie Egan. So what would Jesus do about climate change, particularly as droughts make it harder to turn water into wine? Here with us in Studio 3 for their take on this and other moral and religious questions today are Reverend Irene Monroe, also a syndicated columnist, and Reverend Emmett Price. He's also a professor of music at Northeastern University. It's great to see you both.
Thanks for having us back.
Glad to be here.
Thank you both for coming in. So let's start with yet another botched execution. This time it was out in Arizona. John McCain called this torture. This is the guy who was gasping for breath for, I think, 90 minutes before he finally died. We've had a spate of these. Do you think this is going to make any difference in terms of our reassessing the death penalty, or are we just going to wait till we get the better drugs and we get it down? What do you think, Irene Monroe?
Well, first of all, we can't, and you can't use an inhumane way to think that that will be the humane way to solve this issue. But we've had this, you know, we've seen this before. We've tried the electric chair and we've realized that that set people on fire. We've done hanging. We've seen that that hasn't worked. We've done the firing squad. I don't know why we continually do this. And first of all, this is my personal opinion. We don't have the right to take a person's life. We really don't. And I don't think, number one, that if you want retribution, not only not taking a person's life is not the answer, it also doesn't diminish crime. That's the whole thing.
Yeah, but Irene Monroe, unfortunately, all of the rational arguments, including that it's more expensive to execute someone than it is to have them in jail because of all the mandatory appeals, haven't worked. And the reason we want to talk about that, it's a horrible choice of words, Emmett Price. Is there a trigger? Is there a tipping point that will cause us to join, the United States to join the rest of the civilized world? We're ahead of places like Libya and North Korea in terms of state-sponsored executions for crimes. Some people thought that the Oklahoma one, then the Ohio one, I think I got them right, and then this thing in Arizona was going to do something. Does anything do anything, or we just have to wait till someday the Supreme Court says it violates the cruel and unusual clause in the Eighth Amendment?
Well, I'm not proud of our rankings here, and I hope that at some point, you know, things will get better. With this Congress, I think it's a federal issue again, as well as a SJC, issue. But I mean, on July 24th, the New Republic had a lead article that said 2014 is already the worst year in the history of lethal injection. Another day, another problematic execution. Right. And so that kind of puts the tag on where we are. I mean, Irene's right. There's no humane way to kill anyone, regardless of what we believe about it. But I think things have to change. I'm hoping that we will have some additional advocacy or whatnot to at least draw to, the table that this conversation be had.
But we also disproportionately send people down this path.
I mean, people of color.
People of color.
We do.
And poor people. Yeah. And I just think, again, that if, my whole idea about the penal system in general, that you have to make the distinction between ruining a life and teaching a lesson. And my point is, even that person who has committed such a heinous crime, we learn something by rehabbing that individual and looking, and it helps us to look at where there are fault lines structurally within our system that allowed this person to fall so deeply.
See, that's the reverend in you. I am on the flip side.
On a good day.
No, you know where I am on this? I'm in the Bill O'Reilly school of anti-death penalty people. Mm-hmm. Is if you believe in that someone should suffer for their crimes, injecting them, even if you do it well. I know it's going to upset you, Irene Monroe, but I have to get it out anyway. If you inject them, even if you do it well and smoothly, they're gone. They're done. The suffering is minimal. My attitude is if somebody does something horrible, allow them to try to get their life back in order. But let them think about what they did for the rest of their natural lives rather than just disappearing into the ether in 30 seconds or 3 minutes.
The extended challenge.
Or 90
of
minutes.
It.
I mean, they,
well,
right.
I know. Well, obviously,
it depends, right? 90, if you 90, flop on the gurney.
90 plus minutes. I mean, when we talked about this back in April when the Clayton Lockett.
Was the other guy, right?
Yeah. And his death was so heinous that they actually tried to close the curtain. right? Because of the convulsions and all of the stuff that was going on to his physical body.
So the witnesses couldn't see
it. So my issue is the extended impact, you know, on the individuals who were there to witness it, the families or whatnot. I mean, it becomes a really heinous thing.
It's a gruesome spectacle. It reminds me of people who used to gather around and watch lynchings and then would take as souvenirs body parts of the person that was lynched here. That's something about us as a people that needs to be really examined. What joy do we get? What feeling of satisfaction do we get seeing somebody, you know, disappear like that?
You know, it's one of these, my naivete here is so out of control. I was totally convinced after Newtown that we were finally going to get serious gun control because there can't be anything worse than two dozen 26 and 7-year-olds being executed. Obviously, nothing happened. I also believe, forget these botched executions. I went to law school with Barry Scheck from the Innocence Project. Oh. I was totally convinced. Well, you have Al Sharpton. I have Barry Scheck.
I was going to say,
she went to school with Reverend Al, if you weren't listening last week.
I was totally convinced
that with the success that Scheck and his colleagues had, getting people who were on death row exonerated because they didn't do the crime and scientifically prove it, was going to convince even pro-death penalty people, we can't do this because we're going to make mistakes. You can't fix the mistake once they're gone. Nothing seems to move anybody on gun, not the public. The public's fine. On gun, why are you making a face at me?
No, well, I'm saying you're leaving out the statements from the families of the victims. I mean, the sister of this guy killed a sister, and I think someone else. I think he killed two people.
Wood in Arizona.
Yeah. And it was the sister and the father.
Right. His estranged girlfriend and her father.
Yes. Yeah. And so the sister of the girlfriend comes out and says, you know, okay, so I'm paraphrasing. It took 90 minutes, but look at what he did to my sister.
Well, they're right to a degree.
So that's the thing. You have the other people saying, I don't really care that he had convulsions for a half an hour.
Right.
Because look what he did to my sister. So that's a powerful statement, too.
The challenge is that you cannot make law based on emotional agenda, though.
Right.
Right. And so, you know, there are a number of families who have been tortured by these individuals who have created these heinous crimes against their families and their loved ones. And clearly, many of those individuals will believe the way that they believe based on the situation happening to them. But you can't create legislation based on, you know, that population.
You know what? It furthest to me, it's connected to our bullying culture in many ways. I think what happens is that when we feel like when something's so heinous, that some of these crimes really are, that the only way is retribution, we miss the opportunity. I'm very serious, and maybe this is the pastoral moment in me. We've lose the opportunity to really grow from this. You know, and when I say grow, because right now when I look at the world, and I was telling Emmett, there's wars all over the place, and a lot of it has to do with retribution. We look at Israel and Gaza, Russia and Ukraine. I mean, we have to set a model around how do we deal with our differences in a humane way.
But you're not anti-punishment, I assume. Are you or are you?
I think
punishment should be paired with rehabilitation
whatever. Absolutely, okay. But not taking somebody's life. And of course, I mean, clearly, if someone did this to my loved ones, I'd be rip-roaring pissed. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. But that is not the way we can't emote and we can't be, you know, impetuous in our acts towards justice.
Well, speaking of emote, when these hearings, well, they actually have already started in Massachusetts, these hearings for these juvenile killers. Who, because of the Supreme Court and Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, get hearings to see if they can be paroled, because you can have a life sentence, but it can't be automatic and mandatory. There'd be a lot of motions there, too.
But since we are all revved up with the reverence here, it's been my experience that when you see a lot of the families of murder victims who have been able to forgive, they tend to be very religious, and they're acting out their faith.
But they also move on, though.
Yeah.
They're able to move on and live much more productive lives. Yeah. And not being able to work and not teaching us how to forgive. You know, you have to teach compassion. You have to teach, you know, forgiveness and what's the end game, the good end game of doing that. Because other than that, these people stew in their anger. They really become static.
Well, sometimes some of the religious conversion happens during the trauma of healing through, you know, these heinous crimes and individuals who actually want to, you know, have a conversation with the murderer of their loved one. And in they have this conversation,
South Africa,
you know,
was a good example of that with their truth and reconciliation panel. It was heinous, and for many, many decades. But there was something about if we're going to move individually and as a nation, it's not about forgetting. This is what we must do. Even with Rwanda, the Hutus and the Tutsis, mm-hmm. you have to do that.
Well, you know who's a perfect local example? One of our favorite people, Tina Cherry.
Tina Cherry
from Louis D. Brown Institute. Yeah. Her son, Louis D. Brown, was killed. Mm-hmm. Was he 15? Going to a peace rally around Christmas. Mm-hmm. And she's founded this incredibly wonderful organization that helps people, not only promotes peace, as she calls it, but also helps families who have suffered. She's called, I love this, she isn't offended by this, a wedding planner for funerals.
Yeah.
I mean, she essentially helps families
really?
Through all this.
Wow.
Horror. When we first talked to her about going to meet was it the mother of the guy who killed her son? Mm-hmm. She said, and I have to say, I wish I were this big, two families suffered a horrible loss on that night.
That's right.
The killer's parents and my son, and the parents of my child.
Yeah.
You know, it's just, but it really, you know, you say to yourself, what kind of people are big enough to be able to make those kinds of, take those kind of actions after you've lost somebody?
I think you nurture your family, you nurture a nation around that. You really do. You nurture a people.
Is she not one of the most impressive people you've ever met?
She's one of the most impressive people I've ever met. Yes, she is.
So there you go. Sure. Anyway, let's move on. While we're talking about all this religious stuff here, about what would Jesus do about climate change? There's this Gordon College science professor who wants evangelical Christians like herself to be much better stewards of the earth. She's trying to get some traction because not all, but many evangelicals or Republicans are not really big on the climate change kind of thing. She's trying to change us. So do you think she's got any ability here to kind of make a evangelical net and get something done?
Well, I mean, there's hope. There's hope. You know, I'm the eternal optimist. But I believe, see, here's one of the challenges, that in many of our churches, we teach stewardship is only financial.
Yeah.
And stewardship is really about being good stewards over everything that God created for our usage, right?
Yep.
And so when you think about it that way, then recycling and, you know, being green and all these other ideas that people have are a part of effective stewardship. So it makes sense that you would have an evangelical professor, you know, of the sciences who would be out there preaching
but
this.
But then what would you do about Genesis? You see, because it's always that argument between creationism versus evolution here. And, of course, this is not the Sarah Palin folks that we're talking about because, you know, she says God is this, it's, you know, Earth is made by this intelligent design and that it will be self-correcting, you know, and so why are we even being worried about this? But you're right when you say that you talk about stewardship, that caring for the planet, the environment is also, you know, caring for people. But it's ideology, you know, because it reminds me when I have to tell you this very quick story. When I went out to Loyola University to talk about the politics of biblical interpretation, and I was talking about Katrina, and some person said, well, what do you think happened? Why did it happen? And I said, because, you know, government inefficiency, blah, 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 blah. And she says, no, Reverend, you missed the point. She says, this was foretold in the book of Revelation as well as in Genesis. And I said, well, no, that's a literal definition. She says, no, I have concrete proof. And I said, what is it? She says, the reason why Katrina happened and the reason why those levees broke, very simple. It was because of gambling, gays, and Negro jazz.
Oh, my God.
By the way, we should give this professor at Gordon a little. Her name is Dorothy Borst. She's written a report called Loving the Least of These. And in the Globe Sunday Magazine with a piece, Borst believes, just like you two said, believes strongly in the idea of creation care, which asserts that God tasked humans as the earth's stewards, not its owners. You know, we discussed with both of you last week. I think we concluded that since the Civil Rights Movement, religious leaders, despite championing, we're talking about nationally on a large scale, championing huge numbers of issues, have very few victories to claim since, and that's been 50 years, give or take a couple. Is there potential? I mean, can you? I, you're the eternal optimist, so you don't count in this particular one. We got to go to Irene Monroe. Could this be one where there could be a breakthrough, or is there too much resistance in conservative
America? I think it's too much
resistance
because theologically, how do you hold the book of Genesis? Because either you say that, you know, this is all illusionary, this is metaphorical. Or you say that, you know, we believe the literal tenets of the Bible. So there's a theological schism that it definitely would create and stuff. And you'll find some And you find some that will adhere to this sort of movement towards environmentalism because it's a younger generation. But the older generation, oh, it's they're thumping their Bibles.
I don't get it, though. What do you mean? Because of the believing in the Garden
well, see,
of Eden?
Yeah, the Garden of, oh, absolutely. So a younger generation is the ones that embrace a lot of these sort of progressive social issues.
Right.
You know, like, you know, gay marriage and abortion. But if you are very much of a certain generation, that Bible is your talking book. It is the Word of God.
But what does Genesis say that's opposed to recycling?
That we are supposed to have dominion over the earth.
Oh, okay.
And that's in Genesis 1:1.
Okay. Go ahead.
So here's my quick theological refute, if you will.
Okay.
The whole Old Testament of the Bible gives a story of how we as humans have just continually not listened to God.
Right.
Over and over and over and over and over again, which brings to, again, to the Protestant believers and whatnot, the need for Jesus Christ and this redemption.
Right.
Right. And so when you get to the New Testament, you see that Jesus and then through Peter and Paul and many disciples were talking about here are some of the corrective measures that we didn't do in the Old Testament, but here's how we do it.
See,
and
now,
the evangelical
that's a problem,
perspective
theologically.
Is that, you know, we believe that the Bible is the definitive authority. And so you can't look at the Bible as one chapter or whatnot. You got to look at the Bible as a whole text and get through the whole thing.
Oh, no. See, now the problem is the whole notion that we have this notion of Old Testament versus New Testament versus Hebrew Scripture.
It's not verses, it's continuation.
No, it isn't. Hebrew Bible versus Christian Bible. And it's all this whole notion of Christian domination here is that all the right answers are in the New Testament because of Jesus and all the wrongdoing. Okay, shame on you, Emmett. It's because of the Old Testament.
It's like a good mystery story,
no,
right?
It is.
In the
yeah.
beginning of the mystery story, you get the mystery, and then you work it out through the end.
Yeah.
You got to get all the way to
well,
the last
page.
Well, there
is a very nasty God in the Old Testament as opposed to the New
Testament. The beauty
some nasty
of this discussion
people,
is,
too.
Yeah,
I'm
nasty
stepping
people.
Back. I'm the least religious of the four of us, I should say, and then some in the room. I'm trying to assess the sort of continuing Emmett Price Irene Monroe axis, for lack of a better expression. Here's where I think we are. Correct me if I'm wrong,
okay.
Marjorie. Emmett Price finds hope in the Bible for almost everything. Irene Monroe believes as soon as middle-aged people die out, then we have a chance of getting... Is that pretty much where you are? When the millennials age, we'll
right.
be fine. But
and
before...
then I'll believe in the rapture. Jesus has come... earth.
Okay. And the rapture.
That's good, Jim.
Yeah. Okay. Is it better to get taken up or not to get taken up?
I think you should just be left alone.
Okay.
Come hang with me.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
There's hope for you.
We have time for this Pew Research thing.
We do it quickly.
Well, it's
just a couple of minutes.
This Pew Research, they do all these surveys, of course, and they have a special one, Religious and Public Life Project. And they found that most Americans are pretty okay with Jews and Catholics and evangelical Christians, that a majority of other people that aren't those religions and those who are those religions kind of like themselves. But Muslims and atheists are way down, almost together. I mean, Muslims are suspicious, just like atheists are suspicious. And then Buddhists, Hindus, and Mormons are kind of like in the middle. They're kind of neutral. So is this – what are we to make of this, Ms. Biblical Scholar over there? Irene Monroe.
What I make of this?
Yeah.
Okay.
And again, it's different among younger generation, I should say,
yeah,
too.
Of course
they're much more tolerant of the non-Christians
yeah,
than the
well,
older
I
generation.
Think, number one, we missed something that is really the dominant theme here. We are a Christian nation. So if you're not Christian, of course you would have more suspicion. That's why I was making my point about the Hebrew Bible and the Old Testament here, that is an intentional Christianized reading that shapes the way in which we interpret that. But of course, it's sort of like, you know, if you're in a – oh, here's a good example. If you're in an all-white environment, and then here's Emmett and I, we're two flies in a bowl of milk. We're suspect of you guys, okay?
Yeah.
I'm looking at you, Jim, particularly.
Okay. Yeah, okay.
So, I mean, that's it pretty much.
And what do you think, Emmett?
I mean, I think popular culture has done a huge disservice to our understanding of difference. And I think we have been misguided and miseducated about individuals, particularly who are atheists and particularly of Muslims. I believe that they are good people. And we need to learn more about them, what they believe, and then find the intersections of our beliefs so that we can begin a conversation to learn about one another.
Why do you think people are down on atheists?
Well, because, I mean, there's the old adage of, you know, people who don't believe in anything, you know, would not, you know.
They're less moral.
Can't
they're
trust them.
Yeah,
right.
Less
yeah.
moral.
That's
okay.
A,
but the point is they're probably more moral than anybody because they are not ensconced with doctrination and dogma and creed. They're more likely to do the right thing and be a social justice activist than your Christian right, your zealot, you know, your fanatical Muslim. I mean, they're more likely to do the right thing than someone who's just shaped by some,
and they're
you know.
Good people. And so we define goodness in different ways
and
across
us.
The
and
different
places. And they're among us.
Absolutely.
How about
has there ever been a president or before Barack Obama who has carefully, when he's talked about people of faith, then included people of no faith? I don't know if that's
Jimmy,
the term of art that he used. Did
Jimmy
Carter do that too?
Absolutely.
He spoke about people who
all
are atheists.
People,
yeah.
Absolutely.
I thought you were
and that's
say
what made him a better Christian because he understood mm-hmm. the universality of what the Christian message meant.
Well, you know what made him a better Christian is he didn't talk about it all the time.
That
that's
might
another,
be it
yeah.
I thought
absolutely.
You were going to ask if there had ever been a president who did not have declare a belief, and I don't think there
oh,
ever
well,
has
I can
been.
Oh, well, you know, Thomas Jefferson certainly did, certainly exegeted the Bible. I mean, he had certain passages like Apostle Paul, nothing he said, which I totally agree with him because apostle is known for slaves or to be obedient to their masters and women should be subservient to their husbands.
Yeah.
And I have to look at Jim when I say that.
Okay. Thank
great
you both
to see
for being
both,
here as
always.
The Reverend Ira Monroe, syndicated columnist. You can find her at Huffington Post and Bay Windows. The Reverend Emmett Price is a professor of music at Northeastern University. His latest book, The Black Church and the Hip-Hop Culture Toward Bridging the Generational Divide. Great to talk to you guys, as always. And up next, we're going to talk to you about The Poor Door. Is this something out of Dickens? Is it out of Downton Abbey? How 21st century Manhattan is using 19th century means to separate the hoi polloi from the hoity-toity. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Is America still Israel's best friend?
By the 90s, with Clinton and Rabin, and all things are hunky-dory. And really, as far as American Jews, the erosion starts in the 2000s.
Things are not what they used to be. Author John Judis on America's ever-evolving relationship with Israel. That's next time on The Takeaway from PRI, Public Radio International.
This afternoon at 2, here on 89.7 WGBH.
WGBH programs are here thanks to you. And Mass Eye and Ear. Sense life, experience life. When vision problems affect the way you experience life, experience the difference Mass Eye and Ear can make. Visit masseyeandear.org for more information. And Northeastern University, where youth-inspired researchers are confronting global challenges with a focus on health, security, and sustainability. Learn how Northeastern is making tomorrow happen at northeastern.edu/tomorrow.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Brady and Marjorie. And, you know, just as we've pretty much worn out, I think, the 99% versus the 1% nomenclature, the universe has given us another way to talk about income inequality by way of what's being called, Marjorie, the poor door. This is what people are calling us. I thought the story was in The Onion when I first read this. This is what people are calling a separate entrance for affordable housing. They'll be part of a new luxury building on the Upper West Side of Manhattan. People who pay market rates have access to the gym, the pool, Hudson River views, that's the river on the west side of Manhattan, as well as their own doors and lobby, while the low-income residents get their own portal known as the poor door. This is real. So where are you on this? Should the rich and poor have separate entrances in a mixed-income housing situation? Is this segregation? Or just a very literal way of recognizing what we all know to be true, that there is gross income inequality and unaffordable housing in America? 877-301-8970. Would you live in a place with a poor door? And can you believe in 2014, in a major American city, there are buildings where people have to enter through the rear door? I think it's on an alley, if I'm not incorrect, at this particular location.
Probably.
On the Upper
a
West
long,
Side.
A long, dark, dirty alley.
You know, I got an email this morning that said, I don't understand what you're saying. A friend of mine, actually, who used to be a housing lawyer like I was in New York City. And he said, you know, what are you so upset about? I just said, he says, the gym is only available to the wealthier residents. Did you complain about that? No. The views on the upper floors of the river, which are very desirable. So why is what's the big deal? This is just more a more dramatic manifestation that there are two Americas, there are two New Yorks. And this, what's the most amazing, this was approved in New York City where Bill de Blasio ran, what was his theme? There are two Americas, or whatever.
The Tale of Two Cities.
Yeah, he said Tale of Two
Tale
Cities.
Tale of Two Cities
right.
was his big thing. Yeah, I can't imagine he's that happy about all
he
the
said he's gonna, not going to happen again.
This is getting. But I mean, what happens is they come in to build these luxury buildings and they get tax breaks and they get strictures. And one of the strictures is you've got to have a certain amount of apartments there set aside for low income housing.
Just like in Boston, by the way.
Yeah, just like in Boston. And there. Their way of doing it, I guess, is to make sure that the people going in the poor door are not going to even have access to any of the people going in the rich door. So it's almost like they're in two different buildings. I mean, it's just really blatant. But, you know, it's one of
but
these...
what if they were... Just stay there for 1 second. As appalled as I am by this, mm-hmm. at 877-301-8970, if they were two separate buildings, they're right next door to each other, luxury co-ops, the equivalent of condos in central New York City, where all these people lived who could afford market rate, and right next door to it was housing that was all affordable units. And they obviously, by definition, entered through separate doors. No one would. I mean, that is what it is.
No, I think people would say you get what you pay for. I
mean, right.
So aren't they getting what they pay for here? Well, you could argue that, too. I guess this is just sort of an extension of the affordable housing, luxury housing mix that's so blatant it sort of rubs you the wrong way. I mean, one guy made a great point. And when I first heard this, I thought it was just absolutely ridiculous and horrible. But then this guy argued, well, why don't we just give these developers, make them pay extra to have all luxury housing, and that money goes back to the city, and the city can do something with it in terms of more low-income
linkage.
Housing.
They're called linkage payments.
Yes.
Yeah, Boston.
And instead of having this kind of ridiculous idea where we're going to have X numbers of apartments that are for low-income housing inside this luxury thing, and then allow them to come
well,
up with
I can answer
like
that question.
Corridor.
Then there'd be regions of major American cities where only wealthy people live, and they'd build the affordable housing essentially in ghettos, which are essentially low and moderate income housing would be in low-income ghettos. That's what they do in cities. Our number is 877-301-8970. Did you know about this poor door thing in advance? How does this strike you? And again, I'm not making this up. When I first read the story in the New York Times, I assumed it was some satire written until I read these. Think about this for a second. Two people are walking down the street. I think it's at 40 Riverside Drive, Upper West Side of Manhattan. Two people walking down the street live at the same address. One person enters through the front door. And someone who's in an affordable housing unit, who as far as they know has not committed any crimes, has to walk around to the back of the building and enter through a separate door on an alleyway. I mean, it's surreal to me.
Also, you think about the difference in the ambiance, as we say. I mean, imagine the front door for the luxury housing has a doorman there and beautiful flowers, and you walk inside, and it's well lit, and they have a nice, comfortable couch there for you. If you're waiting for your friend to come down, you sit down. Oh, Mr. Brady, sit down here and have a seat here while you wait for your friend. And I think it might be, you know, just every man for himself at the back door entrance. So it's awful. I mean, the reason in Boston anyway that we wanted to have this mixed housing kind of thing was to prevent it. I mean, a long time ago, Columbia Point used to be a project in Dorchester that was isolated. It was where the Kennedy Library is now. And it was very dangerous. It was full of people that were low-income people, and there were a lot of bad actors there, and it was a very scary place. And one of the thinking of mixing that up was to say, okay, if you have luxury housing, middle-income housing, and low-income housing, you're not going to have these terrible outposts where there's going to be this terrible crime and poor people being preyed on by these criminals and stuff. And that was the thinking. So I'm not sure how this follows in the philosophy of that thinking if everyone is totally segregated. And think of the resentment. If you looked at all these people going up to the gym and they're going in and they're all dressed up, and then you're kind of going around like to the servants' entrance. You know what it reminds me of, too? When they used to have it, it's different, obviously, but when they used to have it, it wasn't that long ago, we used to have different entrances to these swank clubs in Boston, like the Somerset Club and stuff.
Well, like Lockover's, the famous restaurant. Used to have, there was still a sign up, even though it wasn't enforced in the years I went. Wasn't there a women's only? Women had to enter through one door thing?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And there was a great story in the papers at the time about how one of the attorneys that was there at this club, because she was one of the first women to be a partner at the swank law firm, complained that while her colleagues were out eating in the dining room, she had to eat in the pantry.
That's a pretty good story. 877
That was in the 80s.
301 89-70. You know, Marjorie just said what I had mentioned earlier ago. You said, you know they're getting on through the entrance for the luxury places. They get to go to the gym. You wouldn't have objected, nor would I. Obviously, people who are paying more are going to have greater amenities, right? So it's interesting, I guess, because it's a much more visceral kind of thing. When you actually, it's a gym is one thing, a better view, some cocktail area. All those are, I guess, it's one thing. And also, you probably don't see them for the most part. But the separate entrance is just so crass.
I guess the thing is, because there's no opportunity at all to intermingle, none, zero. You're not going to – the wealthier people are not going to see the poor people and vice versa. So if you all came in the same door, maybe you all couldn't go to the gym, but at least there'd be a hi, how are you, you know, when you're going in the elevator together.
Did you hear, by the way, the one thing you – the story I wasn't able to give you that Chelsea gave me. Did you read the thing that when people mistakenly in the affordable units attempt to go in through the luxury thing, they're handcuffed. And well, that's actually not true, but 877-301. I wouldn't be surprised. 301-89. I love whoever named it. The Poor Door.
The Poor Door
has come to New York City.
Story.
And by the way, apparently it's not the first place that has such a thing there. I guess it's just getting a little more publicity than another case. Do you believe also the development, whatever the equivalent of the BRA or something, or the zoning board or whatever it is, approved this thing?
No.
I mean, it's unbelievable to me.
It seems a step or two too far, Jim. I don't want to exaggerate.
I'd say so. Well, it is a step or two too far, literally.
Dan from Lowell. What do you think, Dan?
Hello, Dan. Hi, Dan. Bad connection, Dan. We'll try you again in a second. Who's next?
Michael from Rosendale. Hi, Michael.
Hi, Michael.
Hey, good afternoon. Is it morning? Good afternoon.
Hi.
I got a couple of things in regards to this. Wasn't that a show in the 70s and 80s, Different Strokes?
Oh, yeah, I remember it. I remember
can't
the name
say I ever
of it,
saw
but
it,
I can't
but
say
yeah,
I ever
yeah.
saw it either.
Why, what happened?
Well, no, wasn't that the show where they had the thought that the two young black guys and...
well, obviously, you liked it, whatever it was. Okay, yeah. we never saw it, but what's the current event? We lost them too. Michael, thank you for the call. See if we can do better from Maggie from Uxbridge. Maggie, we hope you last longer here. Hi, Maggie.
Well, I have a question. Now, if the building is on fire,
yes.
do they evacuate the rich people's side before they evacuate the other side? Very much like the Titanic.
Yeah.
It's a very good question.
Maggie, that's a good point. Although the poor people are on the lower floor, so they'd have fewer stairs to come down than the wealthy people who'd have to come down the stairs from the...
Oh, well, go poor people. Woohoo!
Maggie, thank you. We got that whole call. And let's go to Portsmouth,
Jim.
Where Jim is on the phone. Hi, Jim.
Hi. What's it going? My thoughts were, yes, there is definitely some inequality to it, but I mean, there's also the fact that they would be able to have access to some of the school districts was my one side of the, you know, Upper West Side is a whole lot different than where they might be.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a great argument, but I mean, it is along the lines of kind of you get what you pay for. I mean, if you are the person that is, they can afford the, you know, upper floor, so be it. That's great. You bought in at astronomical rates, and there's part of the building that isn't that. I mean, that's it. I mean, it's...
No, Jim, this is not a great connection either. I hear you, and there are many manifestations of this inequality. You're right, school districts is probably one of the most dramatic and arguably one of the most important examples. I guess what this is, because you cited a good one, we could all cite good ones, it's so in your face that it's unbelievable. Everybody knows their apartments aren't going to be as nice. Everybody knows they're not going to get the gym. They're not going to get the views of the Hudson River. It's just, it's almost like it's this gratuitous thing because we don't want the people in the luxury co-ops or the more expensive market rate apartments to what have their view. You know, it's sort of like, remember the whole thing where I mentioned last week, I don't know who we lost him to, where we're talking about, I don't know why we were talking about homelessness last week, Marjorie. Maybe you can refresh my recollection, but I told you there was a lot of complaining in Cambridge from tourists who said they didn't like stepping over homeless people. And I know that was an issue in New York City, too. It's
sort of
like we don't want them entering through the same. It's fine that they have affordable units, just they shouldn't sully our view of our lobby or what. It's sort of like out of sight, out of mind kind of thing.
Right.
And I guess that's it. But it, for some reason, I have a much more visceral reaction to this than I do to almost any other inequity that's ingrained in tons of things.
There's just sort of no pretense. I mean,
Maybe that's what it is.
You're
not even trying.
Okay,
that's right.
We just don't want any kind of mixing. We don't want to have the wealthy people have to deal at all with the. That's why I think, like I said, if it was the same door, and but you still got excluded from the nice cocktail lounge and the gym and all the rest of that stuff, it wouldn't be a big deal because there would be that kind of mingling going on.
What if it turns out when you go to an office building, and we've both done this, there are elevators that go to floor 1 through 6,
right.
And then 6. What if it turns out they have the same entrance? But they had separate elevators, and they had separate elevators, arguably.
Wouldn't be nearly
because,
such a big deal.
Right. But so they could cover it. Even if the intention was to segregate people, it wouldn't be quite as grotesque, correct?
Yeah, well, it's almost as if they're saying it's just so appalling for these wealthier people to have to come in contact
with the poor people.
We're not even going to have them come in the same door. We just don't want to have any mixing going on at all. And that's the part that's really creepy. It's like there's totally – obviously people are richer and people are poorer, but the kind of idea that you can't even meet in the hallway is what they're preventing here.
You know what one of their worries is? Intermarriage. Their worries that – that you enter through the same door, and what's going to happen next?
Yeah, that's right.
Poor people and rich people are going to start
dating,
marrying.
One thing leads to another, and then suddenly there's babies, and what are we going to do then? Ben from Boston, what do you think, Ben?
Hello, Ben.
Oh, hey, Jim. Hey, Marjorie. Thanks for having me. Guys.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
I just wanted to call in because this is actually a huge architectural problem thing that I've been very interested in lately, in the mixing incomes in single establishments. Historically speaking, these kinds of projects usually fail because for some reason or another, the rich people won't move in, and so the only poor people live there, and then the landlords can't afford to keep up with the maintenance on the issue on the buildings, and they all fall apart. Or the rich people just they tend to keep the poor out for whatever reason, the subsidies come in. So this actually, the fact that they have to separate them isn't so much social engineering, I don't think, as it is just a good way to be able to balance that, having the poor be able to live in an environment that is really quite nice, given the cost, I'm sure, and without having the typical fallout from lower-income housing.
Are you an architect, Ben?
I am.
Oh, perfect. Well, but if it turns out, let's assume you're right, and it's not social engineering, which I have a hard time believing, but let's assume you're right. Wouldn't you design something then where if there are two entrances, they're both on the front of the building, one is not an alley, something that's not quite, as Marjorie says, where you don't even drop the pretense that there's inequality.
Oh, absolutely.
You know?
I mean,
right.
I would say the big failure of this is just how it was not very tactfully placed. I mean, I understand separating the two entrances so that, you know, maybe the more well-to-do don't feel like they have to live in the same place as the less fortunate and vice versa. But you don't need to put it in the back alleyway. I would probably put it on the side, maybe with a different color awning or something. Little stuff like that is a good way to do that.
Ben, thank you for the call. We appreciate
it. We've gotten a couple of emails saying that there are poor doors already in Boston, mostly in Chinatown, two different doors for the same building. This
for luxury apartments?
Yeah, this woman that says she does a lot of home visits was pretty shocked when she went to visit someone and was told that she went through the wrong door.
Meaning separate doors for affordable units? Is that it?
That's what at least a couple of our emailers are claiming.
Well, as we said, we have Marty Walsh here tomorrow, 12 to 1. We'll add that to the list.
Let's go to Sheila in Norton.
Hi,
Sheila.
Hi, guys. Actually, on that note, I was thinking, I think of poor doors in Back Bay and Beacon Hill. One, I think, though not cheap, people who live on the ground floor, they have like half a window in the, you know, the townhouses. Seem to be on another level, so to speak. But the other thing is, Marjorie, I bet there'll be interaction with respect to, they probably, unless there's lotteries or how those other people will get the backdoor apartments or condos or whatever they're calling them, because there'll be dog walkers and cleaners of the people who live on the other side of the building. I imagine that they'll work that in, that they'll have their nannies staying there. So I bet there'll be a real draw. If it's a good location of New York, there'll be a lot of people looking for those backdoor places.
By the way, I want you to know I'm still smiling on a whole other level. That's for some reason that is staying with me. Sheila, thank you for the call. There are, she was semi-serious in the first. I mean, there are de facto poor doors. She's right. I mean, people live sort of, you know, one half floor down in a lot of those beautiful buildings on, you know, Marlboro and the river and all that sort of stuff. Let's take one more, Marjorie, if we can.
Let's go to Dave from Warwick, Rhode Island. Hi, Dave.
Hello, Dave. Hi there. How are you doing?
We're good.
Good. In this particular situation, I'm definitely against having a back door in an alley. But I think that, you know, the problem here is that you have a situation that wouldn't be best for anyone. You have, you know, high-end living mixed with lower-end living, and how do you cater to both? How do you cater to the people who are expecting, you know, a higher class of living, and also catering to those who may need subsidized housing? So in doing that, they've created kind of a weird situation with that back door in the alley. Now, in the perfect world, it'd be great to have, you know, a door on the other side of the building, one that looks pretty much the same. But, you know, architecturally, I mean, I don't know how that specific building is. So I think this kind of gets to or speaks to, is it really a good idea to have both housing units in the same building?
Well, that's the threshold issue you were talking about.
Yeah,
before,
that's the threshold issue. I mean, and the idea was to prevent, as I said before, if you have particularly an isolated development that's just for people with subsidized housing, you often will have, not always certainly, but you will often have some crime there, and it makes it very hard for people. So,
it is a form of segregation.
Well,
and
but housing is segregated right now by income anyway,
true too.
Isn't
that's
it true?
True.
And
yeah,
so that's what they're trying to do, is have people with less means in the same building with people with great means. But I don't think you need. I think we've concluded that you really don't want to have people have to go in different doors. I mean, that's, you know, one step too far.
Thanks for the call. Did you see the email from our bosses today? They said if our ratings went down, they want us to enter through the – you didn't see that email?
No, I saw the one that you and I have to enter different
That's what
doors.
I meant, us. That's what – oh, you and I.
Yeah, depending on who
Let's
does
not, okay,
better
fine.
On a particular day. Anyway, okay. Coming up is sports with the Boston Globe's Shira Springer. How 90 is the new 30 when it comes to running, and the price athletes do not have to pay for behaving badly is next on 89.7 WGBH.
Next time on The World Waiting for the New Moon, its emergence marks the end of Ramadan. Many Muslims just look at the calendar, but some prefer to look to the night sky. Calendar? Sky? Which one's right?
So you're encouraged to be a digital Muslim, and you're encouraged to be an analog Muslim. Whatever gets you good.
When exactly does Ramadan end? That enduring question on The World.
This afternoon at 3, here on 89.7 WGBH.
Funding for our programs comes from you and the Joan and James Vernon Cancer Center at Newton Wellesley Hospital, committed to providing patients with quality cancer care, innovative services, and personalized treatment options. Information at nwh.org/cancer. And the X1 DVR from Xfinity, a multi-room DVR. You can record up to 4 shows at once while watching live TV and take your DVR recordings to go. It's all part of the X1 Entertainment Operating System. More at 1-800-XFINITY.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. It's hard to tell if this is an emerging trend or an anomaly, but 90-year-olds are taking to the track in a way that's never happened before. And what unfortunately doesn't seem to be a trend, but rather institutionalized behavior, is a violence problem in the NFL. Ray Rice is the latest example of a player who is pretty much getting away with domestic abuse of the worst sort. Here with us in Studio 3 to go over these and other sports stories is Shira Springer. Shira, as you know, is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hi, Shira.
Hello, Shira. Well, I saw this video of this Ray Rice character before we came down here this morning, and I could not believe what I saw. So tell people the story, please, Shira.
Basically, he was at an Atlantic City casino with his fiancée, Janae Palmer, and they got into a domestic dispute somewhere in the casino, and he knocked her out. And what you see in this video is Ray Rice trying to drag his then unconscious fiance out of the elevator, and her feet get stuck in the door. What looks to be a security guard comes by and they have some words, and he keeps trying to pull her out of the elevator. And then he just kind of looks at the security guard and he just shrugs and gives this kind of fed up look and walks off. And he is subsequently indicted by a grand jury with third-degree felony assault. And you would think that following that, the NFL would take a very harsh stand, this of the league that puts out four-game suspensions for marijuana use. But no, there is a two-game suspension for Mr. Rice for this assault.
How is that? You know, in all seriousness, yeah, this Roger Goodell, who's the commissioner, considering, you know, the tough guy, I don't think, how can they credibly do this? As you say,
they can't.
By the way, a second offense if you smoke a joint is what, 8 games or a year? So if you smoke a second joint and you're a player and you could be out for a year.
Yes. Or Albert Haynesworth, who during a game, you know, if you want a somewhat comparable comparison, stepped on a player's head and for that, in the heat of the game, got a 5-game suspension.
So he was with the Patriots for like a week and a half, right?
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
So he gets 5 games. This guy knocks out his fiance, Colt. And by the way, if you have not seen the video, I assume you have. Literally, it's like he is dragging a dead body out of the elevator. It's unbelievable.
And the lack of concern he shows toward this woman that's his fiance.
And the best part about this whole story, the most bizarre, rather, is that a day after the grand jury indicts, they get married.
Oh, how beautiful. That's a beautiful story. Now, by the way, the defense, correct me if I'm wrong, the Goodell, the commissioner, is using, is at the hearing when I was considering what the sanction should be, what the penalty should be, the fiance become wife says, you know, please be kind to my new husband, Ray. You know, are any, you know, when what's his face? What's the name of the, when Sterling, the owner of the Clippers, made that those racist comments on a private phone call, which were heinous, but they were horrible. But private phone call, virtually every player in the NBA rose up. I don't think they rose up enough, but they did rise up. Are any players in the NFL rising up
because a woman
is knocked out cold and a guy gets a 2-game suspension?
Not that I've heard. You know, nobody is indignant about the fact that Ray Rice is only suspended for 2 games. And I think that's part of the problem. And if you, you know, talking about Goodell, one of the things he said in a letter to Ray Rice that was, you know, released by the league that says, the league is an entity that depends on integrity and in the confidence of the public, and we simply cannot tolerate conduct that endangers others or reflects negatively on our game. This is particularly true with respect to domestic violence. And he's saying that as a league that in 2012, 21 out of 32 teams employed a player that either had been charged with domestic violence or charged with sexual assault. 21 of 32 teams had players with that on their record.
Listen to this quote.
Is what he said.
Listen to this quote. This is so enraging. This is Ravens coach, Ray Rice's coach, John Harbaugh, after the suspension, quote, it's not a big deal. I stand behind Ray.
But this goes all the way down the line. The general manager was saying, we believe he's a good guy. This does not reflect who he is as a person. You know, we believe. And the reason, by the way, he's not, this is going to be expunged from his record. Do you know why? Because he went to counseling. He was offered a pretrial diversion program. So this doesn't go on his record. And everybody's like, you know, and Ray Rice, too, is out there saying, I'm a changed man because of this counseling that I received.
You know, the reason you have to go see this video is because this woman is out cold. It's not just like he hit her, which is bad enough, but he knocked her out.
And who knows what would have happened if that security guard didn't happen upon her and Ray Rice, you know, the fiance and Ray Rice. I mean,
don't you
God
call
forbid
911
exactly.
And say,
exactly.
You could make up some story, I guess, that she hit her head in the elevator or something.
This was a woman in need of medical attention.
Yeah, like in an emergency kind of situation.
Yes.
So the moral of the story is, if you play in the NFL, it's far better to knock your girlfriend unconscious than it is to smoke a joint. Is that not the
takeaway? That's the moral that I take away.
That's beautiful.
Are they worried about your lung capacity from smoking the joint? Is that the reason? Or is it just...
Given the way they've handled concussions, I don't think they're really worried about the health of any of their players.
Okay. Well, that's swell. That's absolutely swell. Let's move on to this other story that... this was a controversy involving EEI, a guy named Kirk Minahan, who's a co-host over there. And he said some very bad things about Erin Andrews after she had this interview. According to Minahan, she asked softball questions from Cardinals pitcher Adam Wainwright during the, I guess it was after the All-Star game.
We have it here, actually.
In between,
we got the sound.
In between innings.
Explain a little bit. Wainwright said immediately after it happened that he threw a meatball. He didn't call it that.
Softball.
Grooved his pitches, yeah.
Grooved his to Derek Jeter, so he could get a hit. You know, Derek Jeter, who's retiring at the end of the year for the New York Yankees. Then he retracted it, saying, and I was only kidding, because he was taking a lot of heat, because the All-Star game winner, now it determines who gets home field advantage. advantage in the World Series, so there was a lot of anger about it. Here is a little bit of Aaron Andrews and that Cardinals pitcher, Adam Wainwright.
The comments you made to the reporters after you pitched, what was that all about?
You know what, sometimes my humor gets taken the wrong way. I feel terrible about this. At no point in my career have I ever gone out and intentionally given up hits.
Well, we appreciate you clearing that up. Don't you love social media?
No, I don't love social media.
Okay, so she wasn't exactly Mike Wallace in that interview.
But she wasn't supposed to be in that context.
Well, here's what I wanted to ask you about. He said, and Minahan said some bad things, and he was suspended and so forth.
Well, he wasn't suspended originally. He said she was a gutless bee and rhymes with rich. They didn't suspend
him. He apologized.
Then his apology was inadequate, and then they suspended him. And by the way, he is a really talented,
very talented,
really
guy.
Funny guy.
Yes. But I'm not really that interested in the controversy with EEI. I guess I'm interested in these sideline reporters like Aaron Andrews. I looked up some of them over the weekend, and every single one of these women is absolutely a total and complete knockout. And so my question to you is, I mean, are some of these women legit, or is it kind of just a big beauty contest and they're kind of all there to just kind of laugh and be nice?
I think it's a little bit of both. You have, depending on in what capacity you are a sideline reporter, I mean, some of them are extremely knowledgeable. I've sat with, worked with, talked to a number of MBA women who are MBA sideline reporters, and they are phenomenally knowledgeable, and they would actually take me aside before a game and say, hey, you know, I have a question about this, or, you know, going back to this injury. They not only were they knowledgeable, but they wanted more knowledge as they were preparing to do their game reports. Some of them are riding on their good looks, but let's not forget, you know, there are probably also men out there riding on their good looks as well. Mm-hmm. This is not isolated to women in the sports field. There are a lot of men out there who I think, really? That's what you got?
But I would say it's not just sideline reporters. 50% of the news anchors in American television can barely read a teleprompter. I'm serious. The men and the women, they're fabulous-looking people. You ask them to speak other than read what scrolls in front of them, and they can't do that. So it's not unique.
Well, I think what I think is different, though, in a lot of cable television, it's a lot of the men are not exactly
more
movie
more
stars.
The guy for the Red Sox is great looking.
Well, I was talking about cable news television.
I'm sorry. Okay.
So you've got women. More and more, this has become sort of the place for women in sports. These sideline reporting jobs.
Yeah.
And to be fair, it is a lot harder than it looks. I mean, as you could tell from some of the background noise there with Aaron Andrews, this was in the middle of a game. I am sure that there was a producer in her saying, listen, you got 45 seconds to do this. She was trying to wrap it up. It's very difficult job to do on the spot within a very strict time limit. This was a lighthearted affair, an all-star game. It was supposed to be fun and light. And now there's this serious issue, and it's a little bit difficult, I think, sometimes, you know, for those sideline reporters to strike a good balance.
So is she respected or is she not respected?
I'm not a huge fan of Aaron Andrews, but
I think... One of the only very few times I'm upset we're not on television, there was a long pause here, Shira Springer. And what was in your head before you answered Marjorie Egan in those 2 seconds?
I think she could be harder hitting. I think, you know, she does perhaps... Her looks give her more the benefit
of the
doubt.
Gives her
more.
Gorgeous woman, if you see her.
Put her in positions perhaps that a more serious reporter, sideline reporter, might be better suited for. But do I think she doesn't know her job or doesn't try hard or doesn't prepare for her job? I think she tries.
Yeah.
I think she prepares. I think she does the best she can. I think sometimes she's in a little over her head.
Okay.
But it doesn't make her what Kirk Minahan called her.
Okay.
You know, but let me just stay on this just for one second. Because not only did
I think there are less attractive women who could do a better job.
Well, yeah, but hold it for a second. Let's talk about people who are not sideline reporters in sports. The vast majority, you're not going to like this, of your colleagues, I don't mean at the Globe, I mean in the industry in general, are gutless themselves, as he described her. If you take away, there are a handful of people in this town who really have the courage to do what I think a lot of political, not all of them, political columnists do, is take on people. Dan Shaughnessy is a perfect example. Oh, he is, your colleague Dan Shaughnessy. I mean, while he's reviled by many athletes, Shaughnessy, to his credit, says what he thinks, then goes in the locker room the next day as opposed to hiding out. So the point I'm trying to make is it's not just a disease of sideline reporters. They're news anchors.
Right.
They're sports columnists. There are a lot of people who are not really good and tough at what they do when they should be.
Let's take Kirk Minahan. It's very easy to sit in a studio on a morning show and say what he said. than to say it to Erin Andrews' face or to criticize her to her
face.
I mean, there's distance there that helps.
Yeah. Well, it is very hard. I mean, I think it is very hard to go into these. I find it very difficult. And you're a woman and you've done it. I would find it really intimidating to go into a locker room, especially when you're worried about who's going to be. Are they in their towels? Are they not in their towels?
I've said for years, bring them all out, give a 15-minute access period.
I totally agree.
Boom, done. You know, we're sitting there waiting sometimes half an hour while they take their showers, get dressed. Who cares? Just right after the game, boom, 15 minutes, sit them outside on a bench, free for all, done, in showers.
Right. It is bizarre.
Why we need to go into
the
locker room?
That is a great point.
We don't need to.
Okay. Here's my favorite story. So we have Ray Rice, who is essentially a criminal who's being suspended for 2 weeks. We have the sideline reporter, Contratomp, who are Charles Ross, Charles Boyle, I hope I get these names right, Orbiller Rogers, and Champion Gotti. Do you know who those people are?
I do, and they're my nominees for Athletes of the Year.
So, and tell us why. And they are mine,
story.
Too. Who
because
are they?
Because they are four men who are 90-plus.
90 years old.
Who entered a set of three relays at the U.S. National Track Championships, the Masters Men's Club Championship, and they set three world records, primarily because there were no relay teams prior to that with, you know, in the 90-plus category, but they are now 90-plus-year-old world record holders.
How much you love, by the way, my favorite quote, I don't know if it was in the New York Times, the Boston Globe, wherever it was, when they met the night before the actual competition, one of them said, now all we have to do is make it through another 24 hours.
I know.
And how great is that?
You don't know if they're joking or not, which I think is what the article said, because it kind of was a bit of a competition of attrition. They just had to get four guys who could stay alive and make it around the track. And there's great video on, I believe it's usatf.com, mm-hmm. of these four men running the 4x100 meter relay.
How great is
that? It's a little bit of a shuffle. But they're kind of shuffling along, and you just have to give their time. They finished in 2:22:37, a lap around the track for them.
I could do 2:27.
And then they did the
4x400,
and then they did the 4x800.
Same four guys?
What was their?
I think they mixed. There were five guys that they mixed in and out.
And what was their athletic background, please?
It was varied. So one guy had been an Army Ranger in three wars. One guy had taken up running, I think, at the age of 60.
Oh my gosh.
Is now like a dedicated runner. And he was like, the next weekend I'm going to do a 5K. And at his retirement home, he does
at
90? Or three.
Yeah. He's doing a 5K?
Yeah. I mean, not only 90, one of these guys was like 96 or 97. You know, and they just they were all from all across the country. They had never really practiced, but handoffs weren't really a big deal because if you see the video, it's sort of like a standstill handoff.
I love the whole story,
but it's great.
You know, the 96 is it 96 or 97?
I think it's 96.
The 96-year-old guy was a sideline reporter until 2 years ago. Do you know that?
I did not.
Seriously,
know that,
for the
Jim.
Senior Network, we only have 2 minutes left. But I read about something happening in Worcester. I assume you'd know because you know all things sports. There's something called a throws. Championship in Worcester. What exactly?
So this is
you know what this is.
The
okay.
throw version of what happened with the men's relay, the 90-plus-year-old men.
What is this?
So instead of having the track, they have the track competition one weekend, one location, and then they have throws, which is just where they throw weights.
Oh, you mean like shots,
shot puts, different weights exactly. I think there's some javelin throwing, there's some pentathlon mixed in there, and it's all sort of the Masters plus. So I think it's 40 and up, and it's club teams. And so I looked at the registration list. So no 90-year-olds competing this weekend in Worcester, but they have, I would say, a couple dozen in the 80-plus divisions. And I'm thinking to myself, okay, running is one thing, but picking up a 15 or 10 or a 20-pound weight and hurling it at 80-plus years old, that's pretty impressive.
I mean, great.
Think about that.
Well, you see all these things all the time saying you got to keep the muscles moving. You keep the muscles moving, they'll keep working, and you can keep going and going and going.
Yeah, I mean, this is following a trend. I mean, there was a 91-year-old woman who set an American record in the women's marathon. She ran a marathon in 7 hours and 7 minutes, I want to say several weeks ago. I mean, I think 90-year-olds are really coming on strong.
Well, 90 is the new 80. I'm sure you know that.
That's great.
Could be the new 40.
90-year-olds
are
coming
Mike
on
Dukakis,
strong.
Mike Dukakis
he
was
great.
Here. He just turned 80. Yep. The former governor, former presidential candidate, was here, 2-3 months ago? What was his line? One of us said to him, on air, you look fabulous, governor. Remember what he said?
He said 80 is the new
20 is 20, what
yeah.
he said.
Well, now, he has walked from his home on Perry Street in Brookline to Northeastern.
Every day.
And stops and picks up garbage the whole way. I mean, talk about you're getting your aerobics, you're getting your bending and lifting.
Yeah, my grandmother, who was when she was 90 plus, used to walk and pick up her groceries a mile and a half each way. She's now 101. So
oh
I think there's
God.
Something to that.
Really? How's she doing at 101?
Excellent.
There's
okay,
hope,
Jim,
Marjorie.
There's
I know
hope for it's us
a,
all.
I knew you were going to say that. Hey, Shira,
Shira
it's great to
thank
see
you
as
very
always.
Much for coming in. Shira is an investigative and enterprise reporter for the sports section
of
the Boston Globe. Thank you again, Shira, and thank you guys for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in tomorrow. Mayor Marty Walsh is with us. He's taking our questions and your questions. We'll talk about immigration. We'll talk about allegations of poor doors in Boston. We'll get to the bottom of that. Our show is a production of WGBH. Our production team, Chelsea Murs, Will Roselip, Amanda McGowan, John Parker is our engineer. Devin Karambalis is our intern. I am Marjorie Egan.
I'm Jim Browdy.
And thank you so much for being with us. And please tune in again tomorrow.